Welcome to the SF Squeecast, in which a group of science fiction and fantasy professionals squee about things SF-nal in a never-ending panel discussion of vague positivity. I'm Lynn Thomas, your moderator. Today, I am joined by Paul Cornell.
Hello.
Elizabeth Baer.
Hi.
And Shauna McGuire.
Hello.
Catherine Valenti was unable to join us today due to a power outage, but we're hoping she might be able to join us later. Oddly enough, as we were making the plans for it, we all submit things that we want to talk about, and it turns out that we were all in kind of a dystopian mood. So all of the things we're going to be talking about today have some sort of tenuous connection to dystopia. We're going to be talking about David Bowie's album Outside. We're also going to be talking about the works of David Lewis Adelman. We're going to be talking about John Wyndham's The Chrysalids, and we're going to be talking about an episode of Phineas and Ferb. If you're dying to hear how we're going to bring all of those things together in a pile of dystopian goodness, stay tuned. Our first topic was brought to the table by Elizabeth Baer, and her topic is the concept album Outside, which was first released in 1995 by David Bowie on Virgin Records. Baer, why don't you tell us a little bit about this album?
Okay, Outside, or as it's sometimes referred to as Number One Outside, is a sort of conjoined concept album and science fiction short story. It deals with the investigation by a detective named Nathan Adler of the, quote, art murder, unquote, of baby Grace, a 14-year-old girl. Art murders in this dystopian future of 1999 are sort of the unholy alliance of serial killers and Christ in a cup of stale pea. It's murder as performance art. Originally, it was meant to be the first of three in a suite, never completed, which actually is sort of thematic performance art in itself, if you think about it. There's a big question in the album of exactly what outside means. Outside of what? It's mostly set in Oxford and London, but it's really unclear as to whether this is England or North America, where there are similarly named places. It's a very impressionist, surrealist thing. There are a series of characters, all of whom are played by David Bowie, whose voice is electronically manipulated in various ways. There are themes of sort of schizophrenia, fragmented reality, fragmented persona and atrocity running through the whole thing. Child sexual abuse, ritual murder, emotional vampirism, suicide cults. Bowie's always famously had that chameleon-like persona. He also kind of has a chameleon-like voice. He has three or four distinct styles and phrasings that he uses. A sort of a somewhat nasal tenor voice that sounds to me creepily like Mark Bolan of T-Rex. They're sort of a baritone Iggy Pop in crooner mode, and here he uses all of them and then alters them further with digital textures. There's a strong techno-industrial influence in the album. He used sort of Burroughsian cut-up techniques on the lyrics, except he did it with a computer program, which ties into the cyberpunky aspects of his future reality. But there's also, like, some really hot jazz piano. My reading of this, and this is an album that's open to many different readings, is that one of the things that's going on here is that various of these characters may be as unstuck in time and out of sequence as the album itself is, in sort of a Slaughterhouse-Five kind of way, that we're dealing not just with an unreliable narrator, but an unreliable narrative and conflicts of space-time. Often in a song, we don't know who's speaking, but we know who isn't, because they name other people. The whole thing has this sort of haunted air. And there's also some interesting metagames where the biography of his detective, Nathan Adler, geographically matches Bowie's own. The other characters include Ramona Stone, who's sort of the prime suspect, except Adler doesn't think she did it. There's a guy named Algeria Touch Shriek who sells mutilation jewelry, a jewelry made out of bits of body parts. There's a fellow named Lydion. Of course, there's Baby Grace herself and Nathan Adler. There's Patty and Melinda, who are, I don't think, actually get speaking roles, but who are named. And I think, to support my reading, there's some lyrical references to Leon cutting a zero in the fabric of time itself. Things seem to have a quantum nature. They can be in multiple states at once, uncollapsed waveforms. We actually get one song from the point of view of the person who is eventually sent to jail for the crime, but we never find out who that is, and that person does not remember committing the crime, but isn't certain they did it. In other words, it's really weird. And it talks a lot about how society is complicit in horrors by supporting them through observation, kind of doing that thing that natural-born killers did without becoming violence porn itself, because I think it's got better humanity and character development than natural-born killers did. And that's about all I had to say off the top of my head. Has anybody else had a chance to listen to it?
I'd listened to it back in the day, actually. And I must say, I always think concept albums that hint towards a concept rather than attempting to tell a story are the best sort. Bowie's done this before, notably on Diamond Dogs, which is one of my favourites. Although Diamond Dogs is ridiculous in a Jack Kirby wonderful way. Outside is much more of a serious proposition. It's interesting that the art of the 1990s, what date is this?
1995.
Quite an optimistic decade, but all the art is pitch black. It's almost as if relative luxury gives us the license in art to be really dark, and in times of genuine trouble, all the art gets escapist again. Anyway, I love The Heart's Filthy Lesson. That's about all I can remember, sorry.
I think that's actually one of my favorite songs on the album. I also really like We Prick You. It always seemed to me to be in the voice of an adult survivor of sexual exploitation, and I'm never quite sure which character that is supposed to be, which I find really interesting.
One of the things that I found really interesting about this album was I watched actually this morning. I had never seen the video for Heart's Filthy Lesson. And the thing that struck me about it is that, A, it had a distinct visual resemblance to Nine Inch Nails' single Closer, which of course came out at a slightly different time, but it was much more focused on the human body as part of the function of art, which of course ties in with the theme of the album. It's, you know, depicting the mutilation of human bodies as opposed to the mutilation of animals, which is what you see in the video for Closer. The thing that I thought was interesting about it is that 1995 in particular, at least in the United States, was a very controversial year for visual art like that, specifically because going back to 1989 and 1990, the National Endowment for the Arts was under a lot of controversy, and then the laws changed in relation to the fact that there was NEA funding for two particular pieces that upset people so much that they lobbied Congress to have NEA's funding cut, and that's Andres Serrano's Piss Christ and the photographs of Robert Mapplethorpe. In 1995, the requirements for actually applying for a grant from the NEA changed so that there was not only less funding to access as an artist of any kind, but you had to specifically say ahead of time what kind of art you were going to create, and it had to pass a panel that actually was looking for quote-unquote general standards of decency and respect for the diverse beliefs and values of the American public. And so it's interesting to me that this video is coming out at a time when, at least in the visual arts in the United States, it could be talking about, and with the concept of the mutilation of the body as art, you know, it could be read as being part of the reaction against this pulling back of artistic freedom as far as funding agencies go. Because it used to be with the NEA that you would just, you know, they would say, here's $500,000, go make some art, you know. And now it's I'm going to make happy fluffy bunnies that turn different colors because that's avant-garde. I find that interesting as a side note to the creation of the album.
Well, actually, not necessarily a side note, because Bowie's tour in support of this album was with Trent Reznor. And
it was
a joint David Bowie Nine Inch Nails extravaganza, variously reviled and lionized to this day by fans of both men. So I think that Nine Inch Nails parallels are entirely intentional there. And I think the album very much is about art as mutilation and mutilation as art. And I think that's exactly what he's talking about. But, you know, where do you draw the line? Do you draw it at actually killing people?
It is really interesting for me, because this is where we start joking about how terrible Lynn's musical taste is in general. And I have a long list of things that I really enjoy that are quite frankly awful music. But in the 90s, like many other people, I was a fan of Nine Inch Nails. And when I was listening to this particular track, of course, you know, the echoes of why Bowie would actually tour with Nine Inch Nails are very much in Heart's Filthy Lesson, just musically speaking. And the visuals I actually found disturbing. I mean, you know, as someone who actually enjoys the music, what I find interesting is that when the music is actually paired with the visuals that go with it, I have a much harder time parsing it and being able to handle it. I'm not someone who deals with violence in a visual medium very well most of the time, unless it's so stylized. Like, John Woo films I'm fine with, and Quentin Tarantino's right on the edge for me, but the notion that, you know, that watching the video I actually found quite disturbing. Like, I may have nightmares tonight because of that video.
Yeah, that video was how I turned my friend Sarah Monette into a David Boyven, because I sent it to her and told her this is what Felix's madness looks like. Felix's character in one of her books who goes mad for quite a long period.
Yes.
And she was like, yes.
Yes, yes.
That's creepy.
Yes. Now that you say that, yeah, that absolutely sounds like Felix's madness.
Because Felix's madness involves people having animal heads and body parts everywhere and pools of blood. All that good stuff.
Yes.
Just those kind of visual and olfactory hallucinations that make everyone's day a little more pleasant.
Fun times.
It's aged really well, hasn't it? I mean, this wasn't a particularly well... Bowie had a very rough 1990s and was regarded as leaping on every trend that came past. But this is the one that's sort of poking up out of that and saying, still a bit important.
Yeah. I actually think this was a little bit of a... I think he was back to being, 5 minutes ahead of the curve at this point. Not well-received then, and now you look at it and you're like, wow, this is really amazing.
One of the things that I find really interesting about it is the notion that because Bowie has this reputation of being 5 minutes ahead, the fact that he then in the 90s got the label of being the trend jumper, I do want to just mention that if you have to be a trend jumper, have the skills that Bowie has to be able to execute those trends amazingly well, because in my head, when you say trend jumper, getting right on the bandwagon, the musician I tend to think of is Madonna, who also has that chameleon-like thing where every 3 years she reinvents herself, colors her hair, does something relatively different. And, as much as I admire her as an artist for her ability to make bank with a limited skill set, I think that when you see someone like Bowie decide that he wants to turn his attention to a trend and actually become part of it, the execution that he's able to commit to is at a far higher level than you see with lots of other artists who are jumping on said trend. So I just wanted to point that out, that yeah, he's also really good at it.
Yes, yes, I agree. Well, let's not talk about the 80s.
The gentleman of the jury, I have in my
You're holding up a Tin Machine album. I see through the internet.
David Bowie did stuff in the 80s that wasn't Labyrinth.
Oh, goodness.
Yes, Shannon, he did.
I can hear you not believing me, but I'm actually... He's Jareth the Goblin King. That's about where I stop and start. I like his pants.
This is where I point out that Labyrinth also has a fabulous score by Trevor Jones, who is amazing.
Okay. Well, then it's clearly time to move to our next segment. The books that Paul is bringing to the table today are by David Lewis Edelman, who's an American novelist and a web programmer in his spare time and day job. He has been nominated for several awards. He has 3 books out. They're part of the Jump 225 trilogy. The first one is called Infoquake, and then there are 2 sequels to that. And Infoquake was nominated for the John W. Campbell Award in 2006 and was named Barnes & Noble's Top SF Novel in 2006. In 2008, in his second year of eligibility, he was nominated once again for the Campbell. He claims on his website that the elevator pitch for this trilogy was Dune meets the Wall Street Journal, and he's got a couple of other permutations of that. So, Paul, why don't you tell us a little bit about these books?
Well, full disclosure, I've grown to be a friend of David as well as a fan, and indeed I was a friend before I read his books. What I really like about the Jump 225 trilogy, the first book, Infoquake, it's likely not entirely formed. He's trying for something. Especially when you recommend that book, you do have to say to people, in the first 20 or 30 pages, you'll be wondering what I've led you into, because it seems a little dull, but it really picks up. What these books are big corporate thrillers, like Dynasty Without the Shoulder Pads. And what they remind me most of is Our Lives at Worldcon. They are about a group of usually entirely sociable, well-disposed towards each other on the surface people who have to knock along in a confined culture of business, having displays and demonstrations and panels, in effect, about their art form, which in this case is body hacking, apps for the human body and mind. And this trilogy came along before the word app actually entered the popular consciousness in the way it has now. They're fueled on Tro, which is their version of coffee, it's a very familiar world to any of us who enjoy the cut and thrust of doing media business in the SF world. And that's what really energizes it for me. They're also almost entirely violence-free until we get to the third one. When David had two shots fired in, I think, the second book, I was really disappointed with him. I thought he was managing to do a thriller which is entirely about people giving each other hard stares across the room and musing, does he know I'm about to launch my exciting product? I mustn't launch before he launches. This is really edge of the seat stuff. And it is. And that's the wonderful thing about it. It's about a programmer called Match, who's a little bit of a rebel. He's a little bit out there. He's a bit crazy because of a fabulous origin story that we learn early on about him failing to do exactly what he should have done to be nice to other people in the event of a bear attack. And the world, Match is not the biggest programmer in the world, but he has good friends and a good little company, and he tries to be on the top as Primos. Now, we all know what Primos is like. Primos is the New York Times top 10 list. It's the DC and Marvel sales charts. It's the chart we look at to see where we are that morning. And for app manufacturers, actually, yes, the life of the iPad seems to be entirely based on this trilogy rather than the other way around, chart of best-selling iPad apps. So, and except what he does is, the apps he makes hack the human body. So you can have a poker face is one of the most popular ones to enable you to just have a really, a poker face, not so nobody can read your expression. It's a world where there isn't much in the way of international travel anymore because virtual conferencing has become so advanced and all-encompassing. People spend a lot of time standing in a pad on their house with their brains and with their minds projected across space to a different office where one person may be there for real and eight of them are there as projections, seeable through the apps in your eyes. It's a completely modded reality to the point where we're quite surprised when a character, it's a big plot point that a character can't actually open a drawer to find something vital because his hand is actually 2,000 miles away. It's fabulous work. It's slightly too early. I think it's underregarded because it actually hit before people started thinking about this stuff in great detail two or three years later. I'm a great fan of it. I love the tension he manages to build without violence. It nearly qualifies as mundane science fiction, that is, part of the mundane science fiction movement, except for some reason, known only to himself, he allows teleportation. So it's not quite entirely within things we regard as physically possible. One of the things I love most about it is that it's not actually post-apocalyptic. There's been... there goes the theme. There's been only a little hiccup a few years back, but almost uniquely for reasonably far future books written these days, this is a continuation of the modern world, and you can see how things continue. It's just history piled on history. That handy break, that handy apocalypse that's usually happened a few years ago to... I'm not quite sure why, almost as a reflex in modern genre fiction. And that's another strength of it. You know, this is a world where there is still commerce, where there is still capitalism. All in all, I think it's a magnificent achievement and rather undervalued. And I'm greatly fond of David, and I look forward to seeing what he does next. Has anybody else read them?
I've been meaning to read them since they came out. That should count at least for...
I haven't, but I'm going to head for a bookstore now.
Oh, thank you. That makes me feel good about the whole thing. Policemen in these books fire needles full of black code that hit you and infest you with an app, which is off any apps that you may have that stop you from the base of your being arrested. And towards the middle of the trilogy, it starts being about multi-real, a new app product where a user can experience all the different quantum realities they might be about to enter into and can choose. So you will always hit the baseball with the baseball bat. And there's a vast fight with people using that, and it's terrific.
All right, fractalism as a basis for decision-making makes me really happy.
What did you do?
It sounds fascinating. It sounds almost like, I don't know if any of you are Red Dwarf fans, but the whole Ace Rimmer storyline with all of the different all of the different Arnold J. Rimmers in all of the different universes, where that one point and then all of the paths diverge. It sounds cool.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes. Well, multi-reel allows you to see all those different paths you might take, and thus actually becomes the Holy Grail, the most important thing in the world. But let's not bring Red Dwarf into this, because there is Pol Pot's Year Zero, there is Ivanova's speech to the alien fleet in Babylon 5, and there's Red Dwarf as the three low points of Western civilization.
Boy! Some of us like Red Dwarf!
I will say that not having an apocalypse is incredibly brave, and that makes it be kind of awesome, because I found that having an apocalypse is the best excuse for showing human behavior at its worst that you can get. You know, everyone here is dialed up to 11, and they're all being horrible, and they're doing these things that you'll say people would never do, but it's all right. We had an apocalypse 10 years ago, and that changed things.
But what's interesting is that these folk choose to exile their children to to the wilderness. They have to experience wild, lived-in, real reality before they can come back to the civilization of augmentation, hence the experience with the bear. It's kind of like they introduce some apocalypse into the lives of all their children.
You'll appreciate these good things I give to you after you have to go out and live on your own for 5 years.
Yeah.
Or you'll just never come back because you'll have moved in with the bear.
We don't have a lot of room here.
They do get killed. You know, the bear has consequences.
As bears often do.
The next thing on my list is that Shannon wanted to talk about John Wyndham's The Chrysalids, which is a novel that was originally published in 1955. It is a post-apocalyptic novel set in rural Labrador, and there's some interesting differences going on in the different societies that develop out of said apocalypse that we are now post. So, Shannon, why don't you take it away?
So, The Chrysalids is actually one of the first things that I remember reading. My mother brought home this big, gray, best science fiction in the world book that was published in, 1958, and it had the novella form of The Chrysalids, which was an edited-down form that was published in America as Rebirth before it got published at full length. And I spent years looking for this, so I kind of blame John Wyndham for a lot of how I think about science fiction. The Chrysalids is set after a nuclear war. We think it was a nuclear war. It's never really stated. We've passed a time called the Tribulations, which is when the world as we know it kind of went wicka, 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 boom, and went away. And now we're dealing with this small village in a place called Labrador, which I thought was a country in Spain. I was very unclear on the concept. With people who are trying very hard to hold to the ways of God. They're very Christian people, and they want to follow God's word, and they want to make sure that the end never comes again. And part of how they're doing that is by ensuring genetic purity. So anything that's born that doesn't look parents, anything that doesn't fit the published norms, and they all very much agree on this. They've got laws on what a cat can look like, what a butterfly can look like, what a people can look like. Anything that doesn't fit the standards is culled. And, they kill them out to try and make sure everything stays pure. But of course, we're in a post-tribulations world. Everything is mutating. Everything is changing. And it's getting harder and harder to get rid of that which is different. And our main characters turn out to be telepaths, which is something Wyndham very much enjoys doing. It's like his hobby. And those telepaths are trying to hide to keep themselves from being culled. They're invisibly different. And I found this just absolutely fascinating, the idea of blasphemy and differences that you couldn't see and could see. And, David fairly early on meets a girl who he finds just lovely. She's absolutely sweet, but she has six toes on her feet. They're just going to kill her. And she winds up having to go live in the woods. Wyndham is an incredibly foundational science fiction author that I don't think we read enough anymore, that people just kind of forget is there, at least here in America. And he wrote, he wrote The Day of the Triffids. He wrote The Midwich Cuckoos, which we keep making over and over again. And he wrote The Chrysalids, which I really think is about his best.
It's very interesting to me because I also remember, I have very vague recollections of reading this book as a child. And the thing that stuck with me the most, if I'm not conflating it with a different book, is I think there's a conversation somewhere early on where David and Petra are discussing why she doesn't just cut the toe off.
Does that sound familiar? It does. There's a point where David and Petra are talking about why she doesn't just cut her toes off, and it's because, one, the scars would give her away. Mm-hmm. You know, they'd still have to hide her feet just as tightly, but now there'd be scarring there, which would prove they had done it on purpose, and because they're not trying to blaspheme.
Right, right. I do remember this. I remember it being a very charming book, but I probably read it 30 years ago, so my critical opinion begins and ends with, oh yeah, I liked that.
I think it's aged really well, and it's a really good example of British science fiction of that time, which was just, there was some brilliant stuff coming out, and David Wyndham was really at the head of a huge amount of it.
Wyndham's kind of halfway between Wells and Clarke. All three of them are the mainstream British science fiction writers who sold immensely to a mainstream audience. And you really can see why, because, as you put it, what you get in Wyndham is bricks and mortar. He works through ideas really clearly. And he invents a few, as you say, we're still making The Village of the Damned. What's the original title?
Midwich Cuckoos.
Midwich Cuckoos, which I read quite recently and is amazingly odd. And the first half of the book, which is just a catalogue of social horrors about everybody in the village being pregnant and what would happen, that's at least as interesting as the second half of the book, which is about the children. And it's big what-ifs that a mainstream audience can really cotton on to. What if this happened to you? And the chrysalid is a little different because there isn't a you for it to happen to. It's the first step in the post-apocalyptic after the end of the time machine. And I think it basically invents the post-apocalyptic. It's a very early post-apocalypse.
I do think that things like the X-Men would not be possible as we know them without Wyndham and without things like the chrysalids, which was the first real posit of you could get superpowers from mutating.
Oh, yes. Stan Lee owes a lot to John
Wyndham. He really does.
Absolutely. And also that idea that the mutants would be outcasts.
Yeah, everyone else that had done mutation had done it a lot like Wells, where you have the Morlocks and the Eoli. But not only are they splitting into two very distinct separate species, they're sticking together. They're all still people. And Wyndham was the first one that said, no, you can be people, but you can also be the other at the same time. Total silence.
We are experiencing a lull.
Awkward moments in a dinner party where we all just look at each other and go, yes, the chrysalids, I haven't read that for decades. And I should have done, it was my job before we came on this podcast, but there was stuff and life and things.
I didn't manage to read yours, but I've got 6 copies of the chrysalids, so if there's any particular edition you'd like to read, I probably have it. I'm a bookworm for things that I like. I want to be able to hand you one and not worry that you won't give it back and then I'll have to hate you.
Are they all the same edition, or are they different editions?
Oh, they're all different editions. I have an original 1955, I have a Rebirth, I have that collection my mom brought me.
So you're the reason nobody can ever find one in a used bookstore?
No, that would be Emergence, is the book I'm hoarding. I've got 11 copies of Emergence. You can't find one on the West Coast for love nor money unless you come to my house.
See, in my line of work, Shauna, we just call that bibliographically complete. We've been talking about things that are dystopian or post-apocalyptic or writing against this trend. The thing that I brought to the table today, you wouldn't think would be terribly dystopian. It's a kid's cartoon. But Phineas and Ferb from Disney Channel does a really great take on a post-apocalyptic story involving time travel. So I'm going to talk a little bit about Phineas and Ferb, and then I'm specifically going to talk about the episode Phineas and Ferb's Quantum Boogaloo, which is just a great episode title, if nothing else. Phineas and Ferb is a show on Disney Channel that is brought to you by Dan Povenmire and Jeff Swampy Marsh, who worked together on the Nickelodeon series Rocko's Modern Life,
and at least one of them worked on Family Guy for a while before they ended up getting together to work on Phineas and Ferb. One of the neat things about Phineas and Ferb is that, well, okay, I should preface this by saying I have an 8-year-old. We watch a lot of kids' television in our household, and while there is a wide range of kids' television, much of it educational, one of the things that we in our household feel like is happening as a trend, even if it isn't, I mean, this is just our perception, is that there's much more emphasis on the educational end and much less emphasis on the imaginative end for kids' television. Now, I say this as someone who grew up, you know, watching The Muppet Show, which was all about, you know, just the most surreal, bizarre things that Jim Henson could come up with for the sake of comedy, and there was no attempt at educational anything. It was vaudeville done with puppets, basically, or music hall, actually, since it was a British co-production at that point. Phineas and Ferb is interesting because it also, as a series, places a huge emphasis on imagination. The basic setup is you have this blended family. So you have the mom and the dad who are married, and you have Phineas and Ferb who are stepbrothers, and their older sister, Candace. Phineas and Ferb are inventors, essentially. The whole series is set up around this notion of you were seeing episodes from their summer vacation. And every day in the summer, they look at one another and they say, what are we going to do today? And they come up with a really convoluted, really massive grand plan for how they're going to entertain themselves for the day. In the meantime, their sister Candace, who is older than them, she's a teenager, spends a lot of time trying to bust them because she sees all of these weird things that they're doing as just that. She thinks they're just completely weird. And she's constantly on the phone calling their mom saying, do you know what these boys are doing in our backyard? And every time towards the end of the episode, she tries to bring mom home to show mom what the boys have been doing all day. Magically, thanks to the machinations of the B-plot, which I'll get to in a moment, all of the evidence of whatever grand plan they'd had for the day have completely disappeared by the time mom turns up in the driveway and says, oh, hey, boys, what's going on? Would you like a snack? How about pie? So the B-plot of these episodes, that's the A-plot. The B-plot always features their pet platypus, Perry, who happens to also be Agent P. He's a secret agent, and his arch-nemesis is Dr. Doofenshmirtz, who is constantly trying to come up with new and convoluted ways to take over the tri-state area where the boys live. They live in the town of Danville, which is part of the tri-state area. And so in the B-plot, you have basically Perry defeating Doofenshmirtz most of the time, and the results of his defeat of Doofenshmirtz somehow meld with the boys' grand machinations for the day to get them out of the visual field of mom when she shows up. So if they've made something massive of metal, usually Doofenshmirtz is off dealing with a giant magnet, and then the magnet, just before mom gets home, grabs the whole big massive construction thing made of metal and yanks it out of the backyard so that she sees nothing when she gets home. It's that sort of thing. So Candace is constantly trying to bust her brothers because they're creative but in her mind weird, and they never seem to get busted. Okay, I hope that's a reasonable encapsulation of the series. But the other thing to keep in mind is that there's always a musical number, which is usually awesome. The music in the series is fantastic, and there are a lot of taglines and running jokes. So every time Phineas and Ferb need supplies for whatever it is they're going to do for the day, they order something from a big company, and invariably the person delivering the thing says, you're awfully young to be building a nuclear converter, to which they reply, yes, I am. So the episode I want to talk about in particular is Phineas and Ferb's Quantum Boogaloo, which is their time machine episode. One of the great things about this series is not only is it great comedy and great musical, but it's also really fantastic science fiction. You've got two boys who spend their entire summer doing all kinds of crazy things, many of which either take on already well-known science fiction tropes, like when they go find mummies or when they build a whole series of robots that then go out of control. They take on a lot of these science fictional ideas and incorporate them into the series. And this is their time machine episode. And basically, the thrust of the episode is that they go to a museum. They find a time machine that doesn't quite work, but their friend Baljeet, who is one of their neighbors, reveals that he figured out for his science project how to create time travel. They fix the time machine, and they go forward in time. Candace busts them for once, and then they go back to their own time, and then they go back forward again, but because Candace has busted them, the future is now dystopian. Because of Candace busting the boys, everybody thinks, oh, we can't let these kids be imaginative anymore. It's too dangerous. And so everybody is basically a kid bot. You know, everybody has to be exactly the same. They're discouraged from any sort of imaginative play or any sort of, you know, building or welding or any of those things that Phineas and Ferb do routinely that are, you know, fairly dangerous, even, you know, even for adults. And so the whole episode basically wraps up with Candace from the future and the original Candace talking to one another and realizing that by busting their brothers, they have changed the future in a horrible way and turned them into the kind of people that Candace doesn't want to hang around with, never mind no. And so she goes back and uses the time machine to not bust them after all. But it's a really great episode about using the time travel motif. So I just, this is me giving a shout out to Phineas and Ferb because they do a lot of really awesome things. And I know Seanan has a lot to say about this series. So Seanan, do you want to weigh in now?
It's good. you know, Phineas and Ferb Quantum Boogaloo is actually awesome because you can start on it without having any knowledge of Phineas and Ferb.
Yep.
I mean, the show is really good about explaining its own concept very quickly, very succinctly. Much like the Muppet Show, it's fun for adults. Half the people I know that watch this show have no children. I have no children. I still stayed up till midnight last night so I could catch the repeat of the new Phineas and Ferb episode, which they had put up against Fringe for some stupid reason. It was a tight call which was going to win. But Quantum Boogaloo, at the same time, is actually playing through Phineas and Ferb continuity. They've done true time travel. It's insane. The thing that Candace uses to actually bust the boys in the future, or from the future, is the roller coaster they built in the very first episode of the show. Baljeet's repair to the time machine was actually made in a previous episode. And then they remembered that they could go back, get the time machine now, fix it, unfix it so they could fix it in the future, and just sort of run around being crazy. It uses all the time travel tropes, and it does them in a way that makes the episode fun to watch 3 and 4 times, because finally something makes sense. Plus, the musical numbers are great.
Yeah, Phineas and Ferb just has fantastic music. It's very, very catchy, and it gets stuck in your head. And actually, I think they won an Emmy, if I'm not mistaken. I know they were nominated for the episode, Dude, We're Getting the Band Back Together, which is the episode about the boys deciding that what they're going to do that day is try to get the band together called Love Handle. That was the band where their parents met and kissed for the first time at their concert. As their anniversary gift to the parents, they decide to hunt down all of the, you know, this is what's it called, reuniting the band. This is their homage to that series, where they find all of the different members of Love Handle and convince them to get back together for a one-night-only concert in their backyard for their parents' anniversary. And the music from this episode is absolutely fantastic, and it gets stuck in your head like, whoa.
They didn't win for that episode. They didn't win that Emmy, but they did win an Emmy this year for a song from an episode called Come Home, Perry, where they lost Perry the Platypus.
I've seen a few. I think that there's a tremendous attractiveness to Phineas and Ferb because they're little geeks. They are us. It is the story of us all. And the optimism of it, the absolutely Tom Swiftian, yes, we can build something that will fix everything, is a wonderful, wonderful thing. I'm a little bored with Perry the Platypus after only a few episodes. He's much more predictable in his subplot than they are in theirs. I think I'd like to see some kind of change up on the whole Perry thing. But this being a kid's show, I think kids would really miss Perry.
Perry grew on me.
Yeah, I'm deeply fond of Perry, mostly because for me, I think just the novelty of having a pet platypus for the boys was something that I thought was fun to play with. And, you know, one of the interviews I saw, the two creators basically said, yeah, we chose a platypus because it was funny looking and nobody knows much about them, so we could do anything. And, you know, so I guess my tolerance for the level of repetition for Perry's plots is deeply amusing. But I have to say, one of the reasons I really like the Perry the Platypus subplots is because of Dr. Doofenshmirtz, who is just, I just want to hug this poor man. He's like, okay, Paul, you're a Doctor Who fan. He's like the most incompetent, insecure version of the Master ever. And I just want to, like, wrap him in a blanket and tell him it's okay. I have deep, deep affection for Doofenshmirtz, and I don't know why. Because I think deep at his core, he just really wants to be loved more than anything. It's just that his concept of how to become loved is to constantly be taking over the tri-state area.
I do like how small an aim that is.
Well, you know, he didn't do so well in his Evil Academy, so he is like a supervillain that has lived up to the Peter principle. He's gone about as far as he can go.
It's also nice to hear that the whole time travel as metaphor, as a means of telling a really interesting story about what might have been. It's time travel as... Well, the original, of course, is Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol, isn't it? Before It's a Wonderful Life and all that. We've had this wonderful stream of time travel stories, often television. Time travel stories are things television does really well, in all sorts of different series, covering the what might have been, which is a really relevant fantasy trope. Book to be written, time travel stories as what might have been in mainstream fantasy tropes by Lynn Thomas.
Yeah, in all of my copious spare time, let me get right on that.
Harry the Platypus, he grew on me after I went to Australia and watched real platypuses for a while, but he was very disappointing because he's so out of proportion to a real platypus. Also, real platypuses are venomous, so I was sort of messed up by Harry the Platypus.
He might be venomous.
That is actually my favorite platypus fact, that platypuses are venomous. Yes. So maybe it's just that, and apparently they have an extraordinarily high metabolism. So maybe it's just that Perry also feels bad for Doofenshmirtz and out of kindness decides not to use his venom on him.
Platypi are one of those creatures that if we weren't around, evolution would have done for them. You know, they're quite clearly sitting there on the edge of natural selection.
Oh, no. The platypus is doing brilliantly. We're about the only thing that's threatened them. They're aquatic, they're very well adapted, they burrow, they've got a good birth rate, they're egg layers, so their females are able to go out and continue foraging, even during the gestation period, without endangering themselves. They're venomous. I mean, they're the smallest, cutest thing that's not arboreal that has survived Australia.
They would actually perish the world.
They would!
You know, we're awfully chirpy for a bunch of dystopian readers today. And listeners, we've talked a bunch about dystopia and post-apocalypse kinds of things. But I'd like to move on now to a new segment that we're trying out, which has been christened by Kat Valenti, The Invisible Cup of Tea, in which we pick a topic, and as a round table, we sit, rather than each of us sort of bringing something forth to pontificate upon that makes us happy, we talk about a selected topic, as though we're all sitting around and having a cup of tea collectively. Wait, I have a sound effect. Okay. That was the pouring of the cup of tea. I don't know if it came across.
It did. I was really hoping it was a cup of tea.
Never trust the folly guy. Okay. So we've got this invisible cup of tea going on.
We've got this invisible cup of tea going on.
So we're doing the invisible cup of tea thing. And what I'm trying to actually tie this, believe it or not, to our theme. Because, you know, we're talking about dystopia and we're talking about post-apocalypse and we're talking about the future. And so Paul had blogged yesterday or a couple days ago about what he called a modest proposal, which I think I'll let him explain and then we will start to talk about it.
Yeah, I rather regret calling it a modest proposal now, because, of course, in the original, that was eating the poor, and it was meant to be a sort of satirical thing, and this is just a modest proposal. My idea is that a lot of conventions these days have a ghost of honour, a author from the past who is long dead, who is celebrated as a guest of honour at the event without having to pay them expenses, and features in, you know, things that happen at the convention and panels and things like that. And that's a great idea and is lovely and especially wonderful when it's celebrating heroes like Charles N. Brown of Locus, who was planning to be at the Reno Worldcon anyway and was only prevented from being there by his awful passing. So I come not to bury that, but I come to offer a suggestion in the opposite direction. I want to see our field, Fantastica, call it what you will, the genre in all its parts, once more gradually turning towards the future. The future is really difficult right now, but that's why we need to once more face in that direction. And things like steampunk seem to me to be looking backwards. Discuss, but that's a discussion for another day. I think there's too much looking backwards. Wouldn't it be wonderful if a convention would appoint a future ghost, a fetus of honour? Stephen Baxter has suggested a star child, a unknown guest of honour at that convention, who is the great science fiction, fantasy, horror novelist, or other big-time creator in this area, but I like novelist, who is born in the year of the convention. So for the Chicago Worldcon in 2012, it would be a novelist who is born in 2012. And gradually, over the decades after the Chicago Worldcon, it would become obvious who this person was, until 50 years later at the 2062 Worldcon. Maybe there would have to be some kind of judging panel for this, or maybe it would be obvious. It would be decided who the fetus of honor, the ghost of the future, at the 2012 Worldcon had been. And there could be panels at the 2012 Worldcon anticipating what the future would be like for this person. There could be all sorts of things, but what it would do is it would focus the genre on the future again. It would get people talking about the future again. And it would also say, there's going to be a Worldcon in 2062. Many of us are going to be at it. I think we all somehow unconsciously think there is a sell-by date on humanity and actually a sell-by date on science fiction fandom. And whereas the latter is much more unlikely than the former, we should all try to make the latter not happen as well. Anyway, that's my proposal.
I'm all for it. I think there should be cake.
Well, there can be cake. I'm willing to give that up as a negotiation principle.
I actually kind of like the notion, partially because I think this encourages the members of fandom who have kids to bring their kids. I could foresee a situation where basically, you know, you have the ability, the Worldcon con runners can not only sell t-shirts for that Worldcon, but also onesies that say future Worldcon GOH, you know.
Oh, yeah.
for the children.
Oh, yeah.
Little t-shirts. The other thing that comes to mind, if you don't want to wait 50 years, would be to do a youth writing contest and have the winner of the contest be the future.
Oh, this would be... We could have the retro future Worldcon guest of honor. Like they could do the retro Hugos for the years when no Hugos were awarded.
Right.
Yeah, these are retro guests of honor in effect.
Yeah.
In 20 years' time, you're right, but you could have a youth writer who was the guest. There's all sorts of variations, and actually it's up to the future, I think, to decide what those variations would be. But I just think if we put the ghost in place soon, and this would, after all, cost nothing at all, I'd just like to see a convention committee go for it. And can you imagine, for a start, the competition it would create between the young authors of the 10, 20, and 30 years after that Worldcon, as they started to realise maybe there were three obvious candidates or something like that? It would become a thing.
There's a murder mystery to be written there, Paul.
I'll give you a ghost of honour.
It would sort of be like the Campbell Award, you know, you get, or the Kentucky Derby, you get your one shot at it.
Well, yes, but there'd be another one along the year, like, oh, yes, we have to be born in that year. So, right, yes, you have one shot there.
Yes, it's kind of a neat idea. And I do like the notion of looking forward. And I say this as someone who works with old books for a living and spends an awful lot of time looking backward as part of my job and daily life. I think it's important to look forward, too, and to believe that there is a future. And not only a future for us as human beings, but also a future for us as a fandom and as a community. Because the most certain way to ensure that there isn't a future is for everybody to sort of start believing, it's not really that important. It's not like it's going to be around in 10 years. And for people to then allow that apathy to convince them not to attend things like Worldcon. So, you know, I think that having a movement of stubborn optimism is something I could buy into very easily.
It also says to individuals like Lauren Bucus will still probably, God willing, be a functioning author in 2062. So many of the young authors, I just picked her name out of a hat. Robert Silverberg will turn out to be immortal and will still be there.
I plan to be 99 and contemplating retirement at that point, so it works out well for me.
I shall be 94, and I'm looking forward to that because I will have an enormous beard and be one of these grand old people of fandom who hobble on for the big heart of what not that I'm ever going to get that, which is always my favourite part of any Hugo ceremony. You know, it sort of says to us about the, you know, how long this culture has been here, you know.
So 50 years from now.
I'm planning to live to be 134, so I'll be there.
I'd be 85 and probably still trying to get people to actually bring papers to the library.
Well, this is there will be no more papers. But I'm using papers out of trees by then. It's after the apocalypse.
I'm using it as a catch-all term.
Believe in
closet masquerades.
We'll be writing on the skins of our vanquished enemies.
Really?
If there is an apocalypse, this may delay world talk for a little while.
This is interesting because I'm actually planning next September to have a birthday party for one of my characters.
Why? Hey.
Because I realized that she was going to be born on September 30th of next year.
Kat and I are planning next May to actually go to Maine and celebrate the 27-year anniversary of the cycle from Stephen King's It.
Oh, hey.
We're going to rent a buffet at a Chinese restaurant.
The Space 1999 fans had a big party on the day that the moon left Earth's orbit. Jerry Anderson completely used to set his stories in the wild future of times where he would still be living and working. I never quite understood that.
The power of suggestion is a very strong thing at times. All right.
Anyway, forgive me a bully pulpit on that. I wish it was slightly more controversial. We've yet to really see a downside.
The end of our podcast. We have a list of questions that our intrepid panelists have put together, which are loosely based on the concept of the Proust questionnaire, which was later ripped off by James Lipton, and who ripped it off from Bernard Pivot. If you've ever seen the end of Inside the Actor's Studio, it's similar to that format where we just ask a bunch of questions and hope people come up with entertaining answers and that it might tell us something maybe about the person answering. You never know. So these are the questions that we ask our Squeakcast guests. And today Bear has graciously volunteered to answer the question. So Paul would like to know, what do you most fear?
You know, that's such a metaphysical question. And in an immediate personal sense, falling. I have a morbid fear of falling. I hate it. I do not dip while dancing. In a broader sense, the vastness of human cruelty and indifference. That's about the most horrible thing I can think of.
Shauna would like to know, can I have a cookie?
Sure, I'll put her in my next book.
Shauna would also like to know, what's the first book you remember reading on your own initiative?
Watership Down, which apparently I started reading at the house of a friend of mom's when I was quite small, and everybody was quite befuddled that I was small enough that people were befuddled that I was reading this giant book. And as I recollect this, I was allowed to take it home with me because they were also amused that this very small child was reading this, 17,000-page book about rabbits.
Fantastic. Paul would like to know, what have you done today to make him feel proud?
Boy, I've been remarkably... What have I done today to make Paul feel proud? I've been remarkably unproductive so far today.
Not working out so far.
No, it's not working out so far. I can tell you what I did yesterday to make you feel proud.
That's going to be today.
But, yeah. I washed the dishes.
That'll do. I'm proud of you.
Thank you.
Bear, you've asked to ask all of our guests, what do you want on your tombstone?
And that's another hard question for me to answer. I joke that I always know what my characters want in their tombstones. I don't know what I want on mine, which I suppose makes me not a very good protagonist. Someone without a goal. I don't know. A nice symmetrical set of dates, Mark Twain got really good ones, the Halley's Comet thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be appropriate.
Okay.
What is your favorite joke? Well, my favorite joke is actually one that Kurt Vonnegut claimed was his favorite joke, which is exceedingly dirty. And what long? Do you actually want me to tell it?
Yeah.
Okay. In the dark days of World War II, in the midst of the Battle of Britain, when morale in England was at an all-time low, it was decided that there would be a radio contest for a limerick to raise everyone's spirits and morale. And limericks being what they are, it was also decided that content would be no bar. So the contest was held. Submissions poured in from all over the war-torn nation, and at the end of the reading process, the judges were unanimous that the best limerick had been sent in by a housewife in Kent. But this lady, who was in her 60s,
was then prevailed upon to read the limerick on the air, and she absolutely categorically refused to because it was far too filthy. And the war effort ground to a halt. Morale plunged. People dragged about. People couldn't get out of bed because they were so upset about not knowing what this limerick was. So eventually, Churchill himself went to this woman on bended knee and begged her. And eventually she agreed that she would go on the radio and read the limerick if she was allowed to substitute a nonsense syllable for every word she felt was too salty for her to say. This was agreed upon, and this is what she finally read on the air. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-fucking-cunt. The old narrative fake-out joke.
Ella won a contest to write the rest of the limerick.
You can host that. The SFC Squeakcast. You know, Squeakcast is really hard to say. The SFC Squeakcast. Yes. SFC. When you're squeeing. Limerick contest. Lister Limerick Challenge, as it were.
We could probably get the little lady my mother cleans house for to read them for us.
Oh, that would be wonderful.
You'd have to be from Hunks or someone like that.
I can see Paul's already working on his version of it.
When you were saying about Watership Down and reading that as a little girl, I was at the SFX weekend the other weekend, and Peter F. Hamilton was sitting beside me with his enormous and wonderful huge space opera books in a pile signing them. And a tiny little girl came up to the table and looked at his books and said to me, "I can read big letters and I can read small letters." And I thought, you're still not up for that at your age.
I'm actually really pleased to hear the Watership Down thing, because that's the first book I remember reading of my own recognizance.
You know, we'd better arrange never to meet in person.
We're guests of honor at the same convention this summer.
I know. I'm worried that there might be an explosion or something. Is this the singularity? Yeah. Okay, there's three more questions to go. Okay. What is your favorite guilty pleasure? That's my question. I don't believe in being guilty about my pleasures. If it is pleasing, I believe one should embrace it. That said, my favorite airplane reading is those horrible Lillian Jackson Brown cat mysteries. And I can't really say that they're a pleasure, but they do keep me entertained. Okay, my next question is, what is your favorite word? Sesquipedalian, because it's so very self-referential. It means more or less using unreasonably long words. Okay, and the question that Kat submitted, what is your quest? To tell stories that bring comfort or succor to people in as honest a way as I possibly can. I can't make that one funny. That's okay. Okay, well, we are now officially at the end of our podcast, so as moderator, it is my joy to thank our panelists, Paul Cornell, Sarah, Elizabeth Bear Wishnevsky, and Sean McGuire. I'm Lynn Thomas, and I want to encourage you all to join us again on the next episode of SF Squeecast. Same squee time, same squee channel. We'll see you soon. Thanks again.